always for being here. Can't tell you how much appreciate your participation and your very excited about our continuing our work here. And that's all I get to say. That's this is Ramesh is running the meeting, but I get to at least welcome you.
Thank you, Representative, and thanks for all being here. I know three of our committee members, right, Beth? They are gonna call in, I guess, and so we'll. Are they already on?
Yeah, I was gonna check. Could everybody on the phone just identify yourselves, please?
This is Vicki from Pollinator Partnership.
Hi, Vicki. Great.
Jeff Stone, Oregon Partnership.
Hey, Jeff. Anybody else? Was that, I'm not sure if somebody just tried to announce themselves. It didn't come through. Was there a third person? Okay, guess not. So Jeff and Vicki from Pollinator Partnership.
Okay, thanks, Beth. So, let's get started here. Probably you guys have done your homework already, I guess. that was given to you guys three weeks ago. Yeah. So I think Beth has done an excellent job of coming up with these topics for the discussion for the next three meetings, I would say. And I would encourage you to come up with any other topics that you guys want to add to this. I know there might be some things missing. She came up with some. I added some to this. And I don't know if Representative Reardon got a chance to look at the topics in the agenda here with each of these different.
We're in the process of reviewing the work plan for completeness. And so I don't have anything to really add today.
Yeah.
But,
feel free to add anything that you feel is missing in here. And then I think we will start the first topic for today's discussion is outreach and education programs. So hopefully everyone who was assigned to do their part hopefully have enough information. And I think we have to maintain our time as well. We have to end around 12:30, right? Yeah, so hopefully I will say that is 20 minutes okay for each of the groups to go over what they have maybe, and then we can have a discussion for 5 minutes on that, and maybe once all the groups are done, then maybe eventually we'll have an hour to discuss or brainstorm a few more ideas as well. If that sounds good, then maybe we'll start with, or Beth, you wanted to go over.
If you don't mind, just real quick, for those who are not familiar with the legislative website, I wanted to just quickly show you how to get to the web page that has the materials for this group's meetings. This will just take a couple minutes, but it's not particularly intuitive, so I wanted to go through it. So if you get to the legislative website, the home page, and then click on the OLIS system here, one thing that trips people up quite often is you have to make sure that you're in the right session. So right now we are in the 2013-2014 interim, so you need to make sure you're there. And then if you go to the committee list, this is considered to be a joint committee because of both Senate and House membership. You go down to Pollinator Health, click on there. Over in the right-hand column will be agendas for any of the meetings. So today we are, Jeff's having a trouble hearing on the phone.
Okay.
Christy, is there anything we can do? So if you click on the agenda for today's meeting, it'll bring up that agenda. And then on this ribbon here, you can find the meeting materials for this agenda. And it will be listed down here with who submitted it. And if you click on the little document icon over to the left, it will show up. And I will just give you an example. Click on the work plan. There it is. That was it. If anybody has trouble accessing these materials, just let me know. I'm the one who can upload things to this website. So as you have materials that you would like to share with the group, send them to me. I can upload them. I think to the extent you can send me materials in advance of the meeting where that topic is going to be discussed, that's ideal. We can't post things to the website in the absence of an agenda, so I need to have an agenda up for a meeting before I can put materials on the website. So if you send them to me, I think that's probably the easiest way to keep track of the materials. And also, I think instead of sending materials just out to the group, If you send them through me, we can keep track of everything, and we won't have kind of a side discussion outside of the meetings themselves happening among the task force members. So any questions? Does that make sense?
Can you check if those...
Yeah, Jeff, is that better? Can you hear any...
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. Are you having trouble with Ramesh, or...
Yeah, I had a hard time, but let's just keep on going.
Oh, okay.
I'm on vacation, and you're lucky I'm not
drunk
anymore.
Jeff, is it my accent or something else?
Did you hear him? He wants to know if it's his accent.
There's nothing.
All right.
Oh, maybe. I think these are not so turned on.
And maybe when we present, we'll move over there.
I think that would be
great.
These
two mics probably work, but Ramesh is nowhere near any of the...
Right.
That mic doesn't do anything for
phones.
Is it? It's these like little satellite guys, so...
I wonder if this particular meeting...
Well, why don't you get started? We'll see if we can move where the mics are.
Okay, I think Amaya, you and Rich want to go ahead with your findings that you have. For the last, or you want to sit together and go, or you have a PowerPoint? I'm not sure what you have. But
just us.
I don't think no one has.
Rich? Should I go next to the speaker?
No, I think she's going to have one right there.
Here.
Rich?
Yes. We are going to start, and I'll go over the themes, and then do you want to go into the detail of the document? Or do you want to start?
I can start with information about the document itself. I'm
okay.
Just wondering, do you want to do doctor after that? Call her after.
We'll call her. Well, yes, if you're texting her
I'm
now.
I'm saving the draft with the text so I can send it quick.
Well, you send it, and I'll do a little intro, and then you start.
Okay.
While you're sending.
Okay.
All right, so this I'm stalling for time while he makes a text to Marla Spivak, who is a beekeeper out of Minnesota who was engaged in some of the citizen efforts there. So Rich did an amazing job pulling together all kinds of education and outreach. I added a few pieces in there, but he really pulled this document together. Quickly, there's a few themes that I found. When you're looking at 12 pages, there's a lot there. One, our states are working to have better communication between beekeepers and growers and other applicators in order to better protect our pollinators from exposure to pesticides. That's a huge theme that we see from the states. Two, there is a huge push to report bee kills and incidents. And what I'm starting to see now is, in that effort to one, help people report, and two, make it easier for them, I think we're finding we also need to figure out what to do with that information. How do we actually investigate? And I think that's like the next piece. We get more information now, what can we do with it? Third one, we put this under outreach, but then I'm not sure it might actually be best management practices. But the states are reaching out and encouraging habitat creation, foraging material, creating more forage for pollinators, and in some cases, increasing the number of managed bees, both on state lands and in private. So there's definitely a push to increase pollinators, just populations and have them grow. The last theme is a bit of a catch-all, but it's around outreach to help people limit exposure to bees of pesticides. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of states working together to create guidance documents to help applicators, mostly specific grower communities, to better understand labels. There's been some, sometimes those labels are pretty complex, and adding the new pollinator information has sometimes made it even have conflicting information. So there's now guidance, states are working to create guidance documents for grower communities to better understand those labels. I also saw seems to be movement in some states to provide more information on the label to help people make decisions. There's this information on, it's called RT25, residual toxicity. Basically, it's how long a product could take to kill, how long after an application a product would still be able to cause lethality to 25% of a population. It's a very blunt measure, but it can tell someone, they look at that label and they can say, aha, 5 days after an application, we might still be seeing bee die-offs as compared to 2 hours later, we might not be seeing anymore. So And I say it's blunt because it doesn't look at all those subtle effects of pesticides when they're exposed but don't die immediately. But it's part of that. So more information is being put on labels, around labels, information about labels and reading them. The last one that kind of information to the public is a little different. It's out of Minnesota. And that's, you guys might have already seen this, but basically making sure the public knows a little bit more about the plants they're buying. And this is where it used to be you could have a plant that's bee attractive, and that bee attractive plant might have, it would have a label saying it's bee attractive, but now if it's treated with a pesticide that might be lethal to that bee, and there's still detectable levels of that pesticide, it can't have that little tag. It can't be advertised as bee attractive if there might be a harmful chemical on it. So really quickly, better communication, better reporting, outreach to help people better understand how to avoid exposures to bees of pesticides, and increasing forage habitat and increasing pollinator populations. Those are the themes that I saw from states.
Thank you. When I put this document together, I basically was trying to collect just about everything I could find on the state that had to do with pollinator protection. And one thing I'd like to mention real quick in regard to this Minnesota one, and we will be talking to a lady who was quite involved in helping to get those laws passed. This one section of the law was called Truth in Advertising. Basically, what that law states is you cannot sell a plant labeled as bee-friendly if there is a detectable amount of any pesticide that's registered as a toxic label to bees. So one of the questions I was going to ask her was, and ODA is, where does the money come from to do this testing? Because if we were to seriously consider something like this, we would have to find out if ODA is going to have that kind of money. You know, so that's a big issue. The other thing is, yes.
Where does it come from in Minnesota?
That's what we're going to find out when we call her.
Well, what's interesting is that was the original bill did not have the detectable component to it, and it was actually down to the wire. The Senate didn't have it, and the House version did. And so I don't know if that's even, I'm curious to see if that's thought through, because you feasibly you can't test every plant anyway. It'll be interesting to learn, you know, to find out if there's detectable levels.
We'll hear more, I'm sure, from the person who's going to speak to us on the phone. But when I talk to my contacts in Minnesota, the way they do their budgeting is just extremely different from how we do our budgeting here. And they basically have a group who decides where natural resource dollars are going to go and then makes recommendations to the legislature. So this was part of what that group recommended to the legislature as part of their environmental spending for the year.
The other thing that I wanted to emphasize in regards to this law is it does not say you can't sell the plant. It only says if you sell the plant, they have to be labeled in a certain way. So it's not putting a restriction on the nursery industry about selling it. It's just talking about labeling. There's a difference there, and I think that's important. Okay. You got another question, George?
Well, I just wanted, in your synopsis, my impression is, and I think I wouldn't take any effort at all to prove that the most money and the most effort that's being expended in pollinator health has to do with honeybee disease and pest control, and you didn't mention that, but really, in your synopsis there. But
okay.
The things that are happening at the ARS and at USDA at OSU and land-grant universities to control honeybee pests and pathogens is far outstrips in total cost those other efforts.
We talked about this a little in that Ramesh is going to be talking some about what Extension's been doing, and we really struggled with
whether you should do that or not.
Right, that's part of why.
The criticism has been from certain parties, from certain directions, is that all of the problems, or most of them, are coming from Varroa and so forth, and not from other sources. And so
right.
I just want to make sure that it's understood that there's a huge effort. being expended to try and solve that problem.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my point.
And I think that's a very valid point. We can't take anything, pesticide, diseases, nutrition, what have you, and talk about it in isolation. Right. All of them have to be together. So we'll take them one step at a time. The other thing is, I was informed by the doctor that she might not be able to work with us today by phone because she is out in the field. I have texted her because she needed at least a 15-minute warning so she can remove her suit, assuming she is available. If we do not hear from her, I will try to get her at a future meeting. But I think some information that she can share with us would be very helpful if we seriously consider some of the laws that Minnesota has passed. Okay. I sent you this document by email the other day, and the reason why I did that is because if you keep it as electronic format, all the links in that document will be active. So if you wish to go back to any of those documents that I've listed, you can do so. If you have questions about any of the other documents, just let me know. I've got already 7 one-inch binders filled with stuff I've been collecting for a while. And I'll be happy to send that by CD if you want some bedtime reading. Are there any questions in regards to what we have listed in document and what Amy has already shared? Okay.
Just one point. We were fortunate. ODA has submitted some additions to your Oregon information, so I've posted that on the website as well. You can see they've added information about Oregon laws and regulations, and just wanted to note that.
And when we kind of put this together, one of the things I wondered is, are we going to, I mean, there's pros and cons to all of the things that are happening in these different states, and is that something that we might talk about, or are we going, I mean, how do these presentations then come into a report and recommendations?
So, Emma, I was thinking maybe you come up with some salient features, like some highlights of what you found and what you think are very attractive and feasible to have here in Oregon. Maybe if you can come, like, summarize maybe 5 or 6 of those, which you think are really to be discussed and you really like those that are being in other states and we can follow those here. Probably I would say that's the best strategy to come up. I know there is a lot of things that we already are doing, and there is so much probably you can shed light onto that. But again, if you guys can come up, each group, I'm not just talking to you, but each of you groups can come up with some 5 or 6 bullet points where you think these are the important ones which we are lacking or we want to expand on those. I don't know. Does it make sense? Or?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of what we did. We found 4 items, and you know, with communication, reporting, outreach, and then increasing pollinator populations and numbers. So maybe should we pull that together?
And we can then, I think we can have a discussion on each of those again. At the end, I would say, like, we'll spend an hour. I don't know if that's a good thing to do. At the end, maybe if you still remember those points, then we can bring that up again and see what can be done. And maybe that helps even Beth to create a report at the end.
So you're deferring conversation, discussion, comment until the end?
No, I think we can have now as well, because they didn't take that long, I guess. So whenever we have time, we can have a discussion as well.
Can we bring in Rose's ideas and as well, since we didn't see those yet, if there's other things that we're already doing or maybe things that Oregon would like to do that we don't, your wish list?
We basically just listed a few efforts that we have, just documents that are on our current website. That we have referenced on this to a list of chemicals that active ingredients that we're going to be testing for. If we have a bee kill case, and we're considering this a living document, and so we are in an area that's primarily, let's say, wheat, that we might be kind of focusing more on chemicals used in that area versus something that would be exclusively
to cranberries and blueberries.
Yeah, George.
So, in looking at the Minnesota information and your analysis of it, so there are a couple of things. First of all, you didn't really mention the compensation issue.
No, we need to bring, yes.
And that's interesting, and it has a lot to do with the incident reporting issue as far as for my industry. Over time, beekeepers have stopped reporting incidences because the state is really, and this is more of a question, is if all of a sudden you had a lot of incidences reported, are you in any position to do any investigations on them as it stands right now, or would that create a problem?
Yes, you're welcome.
No, we respond to cases of bee deaths. I don't want to say all the time, but we have several times this year. We currently are analyzing samples from honeybee deaths. That's one of the reasons that we put together this list of pesticides, because it was quite a huge list. And our laboratory told us that it would take a week and a half to analyze it, and the equipment would be down. You know, part of our issue is we are kind of limited with equipment. Our lab is already working on Saturdays to try to deal with all of the samples that we have. But we have, to my knowledge, we have never not responded to an allegation of bee death. There was a time period last year that we were getting calls about bumblebees if somebody saw one or two dead bees. In that case, we would say there's a limit, 50 bees, and then we would investigate.
What is ODA's current ability to handle samples? How many in a week would you say on the average?
Boy, I'd have to talk with our lab, and it really depends on what else is going on. If we have a lot of drift cases with certain crops, then you know, then that ties up the laboratory. We do give... we do prioritize these samples. If we have a human health case where somebody is alleging that they're sick, then we give that the highest priority. We have a perishable crop, that's a very high priority. But the bee cases, because we have been so concerned, have been also given a high priority, which is why our lab is working on Saturdays. If we had, you know, 80,000 beehives that were negatively affected, like we've heard in other states, then that would be very taxing to our lab. We just don't have the staff to deal with something like that.
So quickly, I've noticed in talking with people in other states, some of the limitations that other states have to be able to investigate, we don't have here. There are different barriers depending on if there was, you know, economic harm to a specific entity, and there's other, so some of those barriers don't exist here that would have stopped investigations from happening, which has allowed us to do some. But then there are still limitations if it's a bee kill on private property. I mean, if you can't see it visibly from outside, you can't always, unless they'll give you permission to enter. So but I don't know if that's ever been an issue.
Well, but if somebody had private property and they had beehives and they had dead bees, then we would investigate if
right.
They invited us on the property.
Well, I know the reason I'm thinking, there was a bee die-off in another state, and they were not granted permission to enter to do sampling. And so that investigation was unable to happen. And I asked about Oregon, and where it is possible that there could be a bee die-off somewhere and they might not let you enter to investigate. But I don't know that it's ever happened. I don't know that it's an issue we've had.
The simple point I was trying to make is that beekeepers, commercial beekeepers, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. have stopped reporting incidences because often the samples are found taken too late to be viable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there has been problems in other states, and maybe even here, I don't know, just anecdotally, of getting anybody out there at all to do the investigation. And in any case, the damage is never compensated. Even if there's wrongdoing, the fine goes, is paid or whatever, and it goes to the state, and the beekeeper in every case has to foot the bill for the damage in rebuilding or repairing the bee colony. So there's hardly any incentive for beekeepers, commercial beekeepers, to report this other than altruistically just to try and, you know, and so that just, in a busy schedule, that makes, that's the fact of the matter. And so what's interesting in the Minnesota one is that there is a compensation clause. You know, I haven't studied it closely to know exactly how it would all work, but that's... And it, the other thing I wanted to say is that the Minnesota law is not only, but is primarily talking about urban and residential kinds of applications and plantings and so forth and so on. And it doesn't say very much about commercial applications and stuff. And I've been thinking about your problem, and your problem as an extension person, having to field the phone calls from people that have one hive or don't know what they're doing because they're brand new or inexperienced and so forth. And it's interesting you have a priority. I mean, this is something, but I'm just going to say that this is an issue, and somehow you have to you would have to prioritize this so that it doesn't muddy and muck up the whole system, because these people, you know, love their bees or whatever, and they see something, they don't know what it is, and then they make the call, and if you're forced to respond, you know, it's like, so, you know, that's the thing. So the compensation issue, the fact that beekeepers have no incentive to report under current situation, and the fact that this is mostly for residential and small and urban situation, the model.
Well, Richard, I should explain the compensation bill in Minnesota. Would you like to?
I wanted to add one thing to your statement about reporting. And I think it's a very valid point, but I don't think it's unique to Oregon.
Right.
Because my information from EPA last year, their report numbers was less than a dozen for the whole year.
For the whole country?
Yes, for the whole country. So it seems like beekeepers all over have lost faith in that system.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. Even to the point of disincentive.
Yeah.
There have been cases where people in the past have turned in pesticide kills, and the state investigation or the county investigator found unregistered materials in the beehive, fined the beekeeper large amounts of money, and did not pursue the incident, the pesticide incident at all. So what message is that saying? Now, I'm not saying that happens in Oregon or it has happened, but stories like that get around, and you just go like, you know, what's the point?
And the Minnesota bill at one point had a registry for beekeepers, and that was fought tooth and nail. So, but here's the...
A mandatory registry? Or?
Yeah. So here's the nutshell of the bee compensation in Minnesota. Basically, if there's been a bee kill that has been determined to be caused by pesticides, if it was a legal application and the applicator has done nothing wrong, there was no negligence, then the state has to pay, and there's up to $20,000. If it was an illegal application, the compensation comes from the applicator or the entity from with an applicator. So that's what... And I see Scott's got it in his hand, so he can tell us. I think I'm not sure the funding for it comes out of a registration fee, but I don't know where the funding comes from.
There's $150,000 appropriated per year.
Could I put that in my own language? Okay, so I'm a farmer.
Right.
I've got a massive bee kill on my property here. Are you saying if I report that, then I'm kind of like throwing the dice as to if I'm found to have applied materials illegally, I'm going to get fined? But if I have applied it correctly, the state might compensate me.
Is the farmer the beekeeper? Because they might aren't always the same.
Okay.
So basically, you're a beekeeper. You might be a farmer or you're not. You might have been hired and there
okay,
was and your bees
saying.
Have died.
Yeah.
The beekeeper gets compensated for their losses up to $20,000. If it was found to be caused by pesticides. If it was caused by a legal application, there was no negligence, the label was followed, then the state makes that, because the state shouldn't be allowing something that would cause that.
Okay, so there's two parties involved at the standing out in the field. It's not just the farmer, it's the farmer and the beekeeper. That's two distinct.
And it might
not be
at a
farm. Some administration costs, clearly, for something like this.
Yeah. You
know, it wouldn't be. I don't know.
They're struggling to understand this. I talked to Marla a little bit yesterday, and Marla says they passed these bills, but again, now when they're trying to implement this, there are too many things that are coming up. So I think Marla may give a better update on this thing. It's pretty, I mean, you know, it's still contentious there, and they're not able to figure out how this compensation should go. And so, but I think the bill has passed for sure. So
yes.
So yeah. So she may have more details when Rich is able to get Marla Spivak online tomorrow, maybe next meeting. So
we're actually trying to get her the number now.
Oh, okay.
So we're almost there.
So, George, a question. You mentioned the story you'd heard where an investigator came out because of an incident and found something illegal the beekeeper had done?
Unregistered materials in the beehive.
So is that a case of a beekeeper using a material maybe to control something that was off-label? Is that type of situation
that's
we're talking about?
Yeah, confused. And it, you know, I mean, I'm not going to try and, I don't know the details of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no,
but,
I was just
you
curious.
Know, we went through, our industry has gone through a long time period when we did not have registered materials that were effective to control varroa. So beekeepers had to do something, and some states chose to when they got this information, they felt like it was necessary to fine the beekeeper for using an unregistered material. Without looking beyond that, say, well, what's the option? Let the bees die or... you know, spend money on an, you know, at any rate. So that has happened, and you know how it's very difficult to know the whole story, but the anecdote has gone like wildfire through the industry, and it has added to this disincentive or lack of incentive anyway to report incidences, and that's why EPA has almost no information on bee kill incidences.
So does it continue to be an issue for having effective treatments for some of these things registered for the uses you guys need?
There's a larger list now than there used to be, and there are a couple materials which are seemingly effective, although some of them are very highly labor-intensive and probably not applicable for commercial beekeeping.
Okay.
But we do have a material that's working, but we're worried because we only have one, that that's insufficient. And so there's constant requests to try and get new materials, but sidelight. The bee industry is small, and it's very difficult, if highly unlikely, that anyone who went through the registration process for a material would ever recover the costs in profits downstream. So there are materials that are probably identified that might work, but the chemical companies are uninterested in registering them and making them available because of the lack of profit potential.
I just realized we brought up the issue of the compensation, which actually is more part of the next meeting.
Yeah, that's
with
what
regulation,
I was wanting to
which
say.
Is, but I'm realizing that was why it wasn't part. But
sorry.
I was just thinking, I mean, but we are talking about the reporting and component, and so maybe thinking, you know, we had communication, reporting, outreach, being guidance, and different information and label additions. And then habitat, and I wonder if we want to talk through those. And staying on the reporting piece, is that something that makes sense for Oregon, or does it not?
Reporting
bee incidents, and then
I think both are tied up. I think why George is bringing up is reporting is tied up to bee compensation eventually. That's why he's bringing up. But again, that's a topic for, as you said, it's a topic for the next time, next week or whatever.
Well, there are some other things. I mean, just with Rose sitting right next to me, a lot of people just simply don't know what to do because the numbers to make contact are not readily available. Now, you can say, well, they're right there, but, you know, in so many cases, like, you know, we'll talk about this too, it's there, but nobody knows about it. And so we need to do a better job of what we're doing. It seems like it ought to work, but it just isn't intuitive. It's not right there. And so, you know, a lot of things just pass, and now the samples are too old, or they've moved on, or whatever. So, I mean, that, I think that's a problem. And then the other question, in some states, it's very clear that even when they do get reports, they don't forward them to the EPA. Is that the case here?
No, we let EPA know, and we also let the
Hello.
Registrar.
Hello.
Hey, Marla. How are you?
Hello, hi, Ramesh. I think I just heard George.
Okay. Identify George anywhere, I guess. So, yeah, we are here, the Oregon Task Force Committee. There is Representative Reardon here next to me, and we have Scott from Oregonians for Food and Shelter. There is Rose Khachaturian from ODA. you know George, and then we have Rich who emailed you, I guess, and there is Amai, and there is Christy as well. So I think, Rich, you want to go ask some questions, I guess? Can you hear us still well, Marla?
Kind of. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think he has a better connection than me. So, yeah, Rich, why don't you go ahead and ask?
Okay. We have lots of questions. One of the first questions was there was an issue in regards to compensation for beekeepers. Could you explain that one a little bit further for our benefit?
I think it was specific. Where is the funding coming from? The funding for that, for the compensation, when it's not an illegal application?
It comes from our Department of Ag, and they have a fund, but I can't tell you what that fund is. You'd have to, I can put you in touch with folks there, and they can explain. It's in their pesticide division. So they have, I don't know why they have this fund or where they got it, but they have money in this fund to compensate me.
A second question was the issue of the labeling and not being able to label it as bee attractive or bee friendly if it had detectable levels. Adding that clause on detectable levels makes it tricky for testing, and we're curious, how is that going to be handled?
Okay, I have to say that both of these bills were passed, and now there's discussion on how to implement. So nothing is implemented yet, and they're discussing the language, interpreting the language, and then they're having task force after the fact to figure out how to do this thing. And so one of the things they're discussing is the no detectable level, and if that's going to be possible or not. So I don't know. If I were doing this, I would say, so there's two sides of this. You've got the public that wants no zebra fit, and then you've got the reality in which if they put, you know, if there's two PPV or maybe three, even maybe up to four, there may be no effect on a bee. You know, or if one glycogen, one or two PPV, there's probably no effect on the bee. Native bee, a wild bee especially, and so maybe that is what should be called the detectable limit. But if you say that there's any in there, the public's going to go ballistic, so it's tricky.
Is there one of the other conversations we were having was regarding reporting of incidents and compensation and the kind of how most beekeepers feel there's a real disincentive to report, and we're trying to figure out if it makes sense to be reporting incidents here in Oregon. Is there, as another beekeeper and someone who's been so involved, do you have any input on that?
So there's huge disincentives to report. So the whole bill was written because of some backyard beekeepers lost 3 colonies due to acute application of fipronil. Acute pesticide poisoning due to fipronil, and so they have no problem reporting the report. The commercial beekeepers, it's problematic to report because if they say that their bees were killed, well, first of all, here's the routine. The beekeeper experienced, I'm going to call it acute toxicity, acute pesticide poisoning, where piles of bees are loaded up in the apiary. First, he's got to call, or he or she's got to call the Department of Ag. That takes a while. They're not prepared. Second of all, they've got to come back to that yard, probably at a time when they got a million other things to do and places to be. And then, so they take the samples, and then they have to report it to the EPA. In many cases, the owner of the land on which they rent, you know, they're renting land through honey. The farmer would kick them off the property if there's an incident. So most of them, many beekeepers, commercial beekeepers in Minnesota, just take the loss, don't report it, keep their mouth shut so they can keep their location.
I can, if there's other questions, I don't know if you can be heard. There's only a few speakers, so I could, if you can't hear them, I can repeat. Is there anyone who has questions?
George, you wanted some. more information.
Yeah, Marla, as I read through these companion bills, there's a lot of reference to residential and city-urban situations and so forth. It's not exactly exclusive of commercial applications, but it seems that that's where your emphasis in the language was. And I was wondering if that's a weakness or if you think there's enough there that it would cover commercial operations as well that actually have an impact on the economy. I'm not discounting the impact on the environment of small-scale beekeepers, but in terms of all of our arguments for the need for maintaining bees, it's been because of their economic value in agriculture and for food production. So how would you respond to that? Do you think there's enough in your companion bills to actually support that commercial activity and protection of it and enhancement of it, or not?
Not even close. So like I said, the whole incident started with backyard beekeepers, and our next, it wouldn't help very much a commercial applicator or commercial beekeeper at all. But you know, you gotta, I guess, start somewhere. Yeah, it's better than nothing, I suppose.
Any other questions?
Do you agree with that, George?
Well, you know, I hadn't really studied it, but it just struck me immediately as that was where the emphasis was, and that was its most clear application. But in reality, I think that in some cases, and we were just having a one-sided conversation about the hobbyists and inexperienced beekeepers and others kind of mucking up the works because they can clog the whole system on where, you know, in reality that incident may have not had any significant impact on food production or on agriculture economy.
Oh,
so
I see. Yeah, right.
And so there has to be some kind of a prioritization so that we don't just overwhelm the extension and the labs and the regulators with these small incidences.
Yeah. Right. So next week is a meeting, the first meeting, in where I'll go and there's a few people from our Department of Ag, and we're going to have the first conversation about what constitutes a dead colony. I mean, what if you have an acute pesticide kill and you have 100 dead bees in front of the colony? Is that worthy of compensation? Probably not. You know, how many bees do you have to have killed in order to get this compensation? And it's a tricky question because it's gonna, that number may float depending on the time of year or what that colony needs to be used for next, or et cetera, et cetera. So it's not going to be an easy thing to implement. And we're, like I said, just next week we're having the first conversation about that. What's a dead colony?
If there isn't another question, I have one more. Is there another?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things we're talking about is looking at all pesticides versus looking just at, you know, neonics and systemics. And I mean, I think there's a lot of views and nuances to it, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that issue.
So I'm sorry, you kind of cut out. So you're going to look at all pesticides, not just the neonics, for what?
When we look at pollinator health and whether it be regulation or outreach and education, how much, when do we focus on systemics or just neonics? When do we look at all pesticides? Just curious what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, we need to be looking at all of them. So people have jumped on the neonic issue, so you don't want to discourage that, but you don't want that to be the sole focus. I mean, the education has to be centered around the overuse of pesticides, and in the case of the neonics, it's the persistence of these. So it's almost like a jumping off point or an entryway into a bigger discussion about pesticide use in general. And when is it
necessary, and in some cases the use of neonics is maybe necessary, and when is it not necessary, and how do we, I guess I would say, how do we use these important chemicals more judiciously rather than blanket using them on everything? But I mean, you run into market problems also, but...
this is Jeff Stone. I'd like to ask you your opinion about that. There are market forces, and there are pest and disease issues which come into play here. So, I understand
issues for what? For crops, for plants. Right.
Because you don't want to ship plants that are susceptible to pests and disease, so it spreads. So right. I'm just curious about what your overarching thoughts on when we're looking at pesticide use in general. How do you, as an expert, factor in the pest and disease side of that equation plus the market?
Well, that's kind of what I just said. There's a time and a place when they must be used. And I'll give you one example. It just came up 2 days ago. I'm at Bachman's Nursery, very huge nursery in Minnesota. And they, even before the bill was passed, they decided, okay, we're going to go as neonic free as we can. It's going to take a while because of where they source their plants and et cetera, but they're going to try. And so, first off, the plants they grow in their nursery themselves, they don't have to use a systemic on those, and that's fine, but they do have to treat them. And so rather than using a foliar application of a systemic neonicotinoid, they're spraying with other compounds. And the foliars, they would have to spray every 15 or so days, the systemics, but the other compounds, they've got to spray every 5 to 8 days. And so now to control the insect pests on these plants. So now increased cost to them, increased labor to them. But the end result is now at the time of sale, those plants will not contain a residue on them that will affect pollinators. Yes, they have to increase use of other compounds, but it won't be inside the plant present in possibly the nectar or pollen when they sell that flowering plant. So it's a trade-off.
Well, it is, and also, how do you increase the cost of the plant? And what about
they did not. This was a business decision on their part, and I tell you, their business is booming. It is such a huge thing to buy flowering plants for bees and pollinators and have them not have a systemic in them, that their business is overwhelmed. They're a huge increase in business.
Well, I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm not getting involved in the emotional side of that one. When you're increasing cost, and what they're talking about is they have to do 5 to 8 days instead of 12, so cost of labor and pesticide use. I also want to see what that chemistry is, if there is increased health risk to humans because they're choosing a different chemical class. So I just be careful about a wide swath assumption there, but I just want to get your expert opinion about what you think that means in the final analysis.
Well, I can't speak for this particular company, but another big nursery did the same thing, Gerton's, and they made a conscious decision. Now, what they're going to apply, maybe they're applying organic compounds. Oh, I don't know what they're applying. They didn't say. But they did say they have to increase the use of these in order to sell them. And also, when they import a lot of plants, too, and in order to even get them imported into the United States, they have to be treated. So they run into, there's going to be a bunch of plants that they can't control. And do they resource those plants? And these are business decisions that they'll make, in the upcoming years, how to do this. As far as that's the nursery industry, and I guess it's their business decision how they manage, how they do this thing. And for farmers and everything, most of the farmers in Minnesota You know, I just had a call, another example that happened yesterday. A pesticide applicator called me and said, I need to know where the beekeepers are in Minnesota, and actually southern Minnesota, because I'm going to be spraying and I need to not kill these colonies. And I said, well, there's no registration of colonies in Minnesota. And what the best thing would for him to do would be to talk to the landowner or the person that, the farmer that needs the application, and ask them if there's bees around or if he knows the beekeepers, and have a conversation, allow the beekeeper and the landowner or the farmer to have a conversation about what he's going to spray with and when and what time of day. And he was very, very amenable to doing that and spraying later in the day and going over the list of alternative compounds that he had. And when I speak to pesticide applicators, the majority of them are very, very willing to change some practices to protect pollinators.
I just want to be sure, I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying that there are pros and cons. There are trade-offs.
Of course.
When you change chemistries, and you can't use the same chemistry over and over and have the pest resistance that you need. So,
sure.
I mean, people do have an integrated pest management system, and maybe that's how we talk about this, is what is your IPM program in order to maximize pollinator protection. But that's a different conversation than what I'm hearing.
Marla, on this, I think we are talking about judicious use, and one thing I've seen, and Jeff, you might want to weigh in on this as well, I've been reading different pieces about nursery applications and labeled rates and how the maximum application rate is quite a bit higher than what is needed to be effective for the vast majority of pests in most instances. Granted, you never know when some year is going to come up and there's going to be something you hadn't expected or a really bad outbreak. But I'm curious, Marla, if that's something you've, when you talk about judicious use, is that something you've looked into, efficacy rate as compared to maximum application rates and what people are doing in that arena?
Yes, it's my understanding. So I'm not a pesticide expert, okay? I'm learning along with all of us. But my understanding is the pesticide labeling and application allowance in urban landscapes is much, much higher than it is in agricultural landscapes on farms. So on farms, it's always specified you can only have a certain amount of pesticide, you know, active ingredient per acre or whatever it is. But that's not the case in urban environments. And the labeling is quite different. Much of the labeling doesn't even contain anything about bee or pollinator toxicity. They've recently, the EPA has changed that slightly. But so the rules are different for urban, including nurseries, than it is for farms, and I think those two things should come together a little bit more. I think there really needs to be really careful review of pesticide use in urban landscapes.
Yeah,
this is Rose Kechadorian with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We have discussed the label deficiencies with EPA about the difficulty of trying to calculate the pounds of active ingredient that might be in a product rather than just how much formulated product you have. And also that there isn't a maximum amount that you can apply. And at one point, EPA had made the suggestions that they would put a maximum number of pounds of active ingredient per acre that a homeowner could apply. And we shared that might not be as valuable as if they put that in per 1,000 square feet. So we might be seeing some labels.
Can you repeat that last part? That might not be as valuable as if they would.
Well, to put pounds per acre on a homeowner label, it has limited value because the homeowner doesn't know how many.
What do you want them to put on instead? That's what I missed.
The amount that a product, and then they can also put the amount of active ingredient per 1,000 square feet or per 10,000 square feet, something that would be more meaningful to a homeowner.
Right. Yeah, that's what needs to be done. That's what I would agree with.
Rose, is there a way that while, because EPA is looking into it, and they've basically said it's going to be a few years, and part of what Representative Reardon brought us together on is there something we can do in the meantime? is there something that Aura can do in the meantime? When we look at, I mean, you know, the study that I'm thinking of looked at Apple applications, and, you know, and so we're looking at a difference between 12 to 120 times more active ingredient allowed on a tree in a backyard compared to ag. Obviously, there's a discord there. Can Oregon do something in the meantime, and what is it?
Wow. That's
not to put you on the spot.
I know that's it. I don't know how much it influenced the task force. That is a tough one. I think that, you know, right now I'm in the process of writing a letter to EPA to comment about their pollinator assessment plan that they have. And this is something that I could at least include in that. I know that they're going to be changing their labels again. But as far as in the immediate future, I think that's really up to this task force as far as what you end up doing with that. If there are concerns as far as the rate of application, at this point, we are registering those products. And if that's a concern, then that's something that the legislature will have to deal with.
Yes. So, Rose, I'm confused about
yes.
this. The EPA develops the original label, and then it comes to Oregon, and then Oregon, if I'm understanding you correctly, has some latitude in terms of amending or changing the label for Oregon use, or to what degree is that the truth?
What the whole process is that the registrant, the pesticide company, sends the label to EPA, and EPA approves or not approves it. Then it comes to each individual state. And for the most part, all the states, except California has a different process, accepts that label. It was very unusual for Oregon to say that they need to put a prohibitive statement regarding linden trees on the label. We did that only one other time with an herbicide, chlorpyrrolid, that was being found in compost. And for that, we went to rulemaking to do that. This time,
really quick,
we made it.
Do we still need Marla? I know
no.
She was busy. Okay,
no.
Anything else for Marla?
I have a question.
Oh, okay. Marla, we still need you.
Hold on a minute. I just want to say a couple of things. The suggestion, can you hear me? I'm sorry?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. One thing that I would like Minnesota to do, and I don't know if Oregon can do this, is just simply to have public pesticide records like they do in California. I think that would be very helpful. And another thing is that any legislation, I think, in my opinion, if you go for a ban on one class of insecticides, we're really not solving the problem, any problems. And so the solutions I see are ones that kind of work at changing the system. So, my kind of ad nauseum, I've been saying, if we can get more flowers that these like in the landscape and to not treat those flowers, it doesn't talk about reducing pesticide use anywhere else. It talks about planting food for bees and keeping that food for the bees clean. But what it ends up doing is that people have to pay attention to drift and how you keep those particular plants clean. So it ends up moving the system instead of trying to change the whole system all at once. Does that make sense?
Yes. We do on the books have a pesticide use reporting system that sunsets in 2019. We do have a pesticide use reporting system, but it's only on the books. It's been defunded. So.
I can't really hear. I'm sorry. It's not public record.
No.
We have a reporting system too in Minnesota, but the public can't see it.
Ours is defunded, so it's not actually occurring at this time.
Oh, I see.
I think Representative Reardon also had one question for you.
Yeah, Marla, thank you for joining us today. My question is, do you have outreach in Minnesota for the urban users of various pesticides? Do you have any kind of program? Because we seem to talk about the commercial users, we talk about ag users, restricted use people, but how about the home gardener folks? Anything going there that you can help us with?
No, there is the Minnesota, the Nursery and Landscape Association, and there is a huge Master Gardener program, and that's, if I were going to do anything, it'd be working with the Master Gardener program. But there, at this point, there is, other than the Nursery and Urban Landscape Association, I don't know of any direct outreach to pesticide applicators.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I gotta go. Sorry, I just went through the colonies, but now I get to go weed whack.
Thank you very much, Marla.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye,
George.
Bye.
I'd like to address something that George had asked me and I didn't answer. Is that okay? First, I really appreciate your sensitivity as far as if you have a lot of backyard beekeepers and they have a few bees that die, that they're kind of going to overwhelm the department, so we can't really respond to larger cases. So I do appreciate that. You asked if the same thing would happen in Oregon in reference to if we went out on a bee kill case and we found that the beekeeper was using products illegally. That does happen sometimes in other cases where we're called in to report reports of, let's say, crop damage, and then we'll find out that farmer has actually used something illegally. We can't ignore that information in that particular case, and we couldn't ignore it if we went on a bee kill investigation and we found that the beekeeper had also used something illegally. So yes, it might be a disincentive to a beekeeper who's doing something illegally. But it also, I think it's been difficult for regulatory agencies to then identify, you know, if there are bad actors out there as far as particular pesticides. Are there particular types of applications that are problematic if we don't get called in to be able to investigate those incidents? So we lose valuable information.
The current funding that supports your lab, does it come out of your regular budget, or is it also supplemented somewhere else, or what?
Well, we get some money from EPA. We have a cooperative agreement, and then we have money from pesticide registrations. So these are not, these programs aren't general funded. We have the Pesticide Analytical Response Center that's general funded. Otherwise, we're just funded with registration fees, which are $160 per product, and we get money from EPA.
Okay, I think we'll, Rich, if you don't have anything else, then we'll switch to George and Christy, I guess.
You
want to
go first?
I want you to go first.
Last week, George and I, or maybe like 10 days ago, George and I decided to divvy up. He was going to talk about some national nonprofits, and I was going to talk to some Oregon nonprofits. And I sent an email on the 23rd of July and didn't hear back from anybody. So I did talk to Amay from Xerces today. She was on vacation when I sent the email, and I think so was Lisa from Beyond Toxic. So she particularly mentioned Xerces doing work on the forage and habitat creation side of things, but we aren't really sure if that fits under education and outreach, so I don't know. But I think when we decide to talk more about that issue, maybe we could talk a little bit more about what Xerces is doing there. And then I know Beyond Toxics has produced some materials and done a lot of work reaching out to the community in Eugene with educational materials about how to basically minimize, what is the word we used? Limit exposure to pesticides for folks that show up at the various events where they have tables and things like that, as well as their own list. So that's what I could glean off of their website, but I'm happy to share more information when I have it. And if anybody else has ideas about Oregon nonprofits that are doing that kind of work, let me know. I really didn't know where to begin and asked the two people I thought would know, and of course it's the end of summer or middle of summer and it's the vacation abyss of email, so I feel like I totally dropped the ball, but I will just get back to you guys if I hear anything interesting and write something up once I have some information, if any. So that's where I am.
Okay,
thanks, George.
It's too bad we don't have somebody in a group that knows something about Xerxes, we could ask them. Does Xerxes have a way to push information out, or I know you have a website, you have booklets and all kinds of things.
Pretty photos of bees.
You have great photos of bees. And how does somebody know to get to Xerxes?
So how do you get to the information? I'm sorry, what do you...
How would you know that Xerxes exists and provides bee information? So I'm trying to think of the homeowner.
You know, a lot of our work, honestly, we have that... Most of our forage and habitat work is with conventional farmers. We're working on the farm to have them create farms that are friendly to beneficial insects as well as native pollinators, and creating forage and habitat. But we do have all kinds of guides for homeowners, and how do we get that information? Isn't that always the question? I'm not sure. I mean, I know we link through with, you know, Metro. I mean, I think if we link with local governments and the entities that are providing information and through the government with the county extensions, some of what we have can filter through and be included with the information we have.
Yeah, kind of hoping that we find out there's a lot of good information already available. You know, maybe our task becomes to do a better job of, 911 for pesticides or something. You call or you go to some location to find out where these resources are, as opposed to inventing and producing and maintaining all of those documents. So just kind of probing a little bit
and
to see what's
there. Our materials are more on the how do you create habitat and what are the plants you want to plant, and we have it sectioned off by different regions of the country. In some ways, bringing it into point of sale for getting information out about the pesticides. And I know that was when we get to Jeff and what are businesses doing, there's a lot of businesses that are trying to get more information out to people so that they can know, they can make more choices about what pesticides and what options they have.
Oh, I'm sorry, I swear I turned this down.
Maybe they
at least you have a good rock in there. Stop.
Go away.
Oh, sorry, this is Vicki on the line from Pollinator Partnership, and I guess my question is, I know you're focusing on local Oregon-related issues, but we have a national program, and I know George and the representative Rita actually have received copies of our outreach materials that do target the home user as well as the professional user of pesticides. It's an outreach booklet that basically does describe management practices and could easily be distributed at point of sale. So there is one product that exists. Distribution and delivery to point of sale is another element that definitely takes a network. So I would definitely put that out there, unless there's a real focus on it being local from Oregon rather than a national program.
No, that's fine. I just was assigned Oregon, and George was assigned some national groups. But I don't know if he...
Yeah, Vicki, I was gonna give you an opportunity to toot your horn. But in terms of... we have a spate of unauthorized phone calls going on here. So there were a couple things I wanted you to talk about in terms of forage. You've already mentioned several, and you have not only a homeowner, but you also have a lot of Million Points program, and you have been working hard on roadsides and other land uses and stuff. I did want to mention that Xerxes has a great deal of influence on governments. NRCS has a contract with Xerxes to develop seed mixes and to have land plans for certain uses and stuff. I think Metro locally also does that. And so a lot of their work is actually available through the government entities that they have a contract with to develop that information. So, but I also wanted you, Vicki, to talk about your applicators training program. That is something we haven't really talked about yet today, but that's one of the areas that looks to me, at any rate, I'm speaking for myself, we have some gaps in training applicators. And so you want to talk a little bit about your program that's being beta tested right now?
What you can do to actually shift the behavior, have the good clean habitat out there that is not being sprayed because it's being managed to support bees, to best management practice goals. It's slow and steady, but over time, just with the same way that you get more pollinator practices implemented on farmland through NRCS practices, it does make a change. So that's something that we're always going to be slow and steady on. So now I'll switch points and talk about our pesticide applicator training program. The vast majority of incidences that are bee kills result from inappropriate application of a product. So someone didn't do it right, either by omission or they weren't paying attention. And the regulation of pesticide application and the training or the requirement if you do or do not need to be trained to apply a product varies by state and actually of the responsibility of the state, so it's not something that can be legislated nationally. It has to go state by state. And what we've done is fit the education outreach component into a model that can be used by every state is the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign Pesticide Task Force a few years back developed a continuing education credit and curriculum for certified pesticide applicators. Which do exist in all states. That's not to say that you have to be one to apply a pesticide, but the certification does exist. And to keep your certification current annually, these individuals have to go for retraining credits. So what we have is an option of a retraining credit where they get the equivalent of 3 hours of training, and it's focused on applying pesticides in a mindful manner that protects pollinators. It includes a video and a workbook, and the video has been produced doing actual field tests and applications by applicators for applicators, so it's a really great learning tool. We are going to launch a beta test of this program this year, and that's something that will be discussed at the upcoming NACC meeting in October in Washington, D.C. We're looking for candidate partners to do the beta test. So we'd be very open to Oregon being a state that would be interested in doing a beta test through their state pesticide applicator training program.
I didn't completely understand. There's a certification program that applicators can receive to be more pollinator protective.
Retraining,
right, and it also gives...
Retraining, yes. It's in the context of... the actual program that you get, that you use to get trained as a certified applicator is very technical and really focuses us on the safety of human health in terms of use of the pesticide. And there really isn't the opportunity into the initial training to put in anything else, environmental, pollinator, but because it's mandatory for them to retrain annually to keep their certification current. And they can retrain based on taking modules that are just approved by the pesticide applicator organization in the state. If this module is approved, it'll be one of many choices they could make. Hopefully it's the choice they choose because it's much more interesting than just listening to the laws about pesticides. And they learn how to protect pollinators. So that's what this training will be.
Okay. So I got it. I thought it was a separate certification. And for a state to be a beta test, what would that mean?
Can you hear a beep up? It was really quiet for me.
There's a mic right there, May. You just need to speak up.
What would it mean to be a beta, for Oregon to beta test this? We would just include it.
Well, we would run the actual training, and because it hasn't, we would test it with a group of applicators that are getting recertified and see if there are any bumps or debugs that have to be done. The program was created by a variety of stakeholders, so we're pretty sure that it speaks to the right audience, conveys the right message correctly, but you also never know. So that's what we mean by beta test. So first you test to make sure that the message as we see it is getting across correctly to the students.
So would this be considered an online course?
We've created it right now as a video. You physically have to show up, sign in, go through a video, and there's an accompanying workbook that you complete as you go through the video. So it is kind of like a, you know, mini training course seminar. And we could definitely launch it in a webinar form, but that will be, if that qualifies for recertification and continuing education, would probably vary by state, because in some of them you physically have to attend something rather than viewing it by proxy.
Yeah, we would be interested in working with you and taking a look at the video. This is Rose Khachaturian with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We would have to, you know, of course, view it to determine whether we were, you know, the number of credits we would give for it. But yes, we can work together on this.
So there was a copy of the video that Representative Reardon received from us, and we've labeled it as a draft, do not distribute. But that could definitely be viewed by yourself to see if that's something. It's almost complete, the video, so it's something that you could review and see if it's within the right flavor of what would work for you.
Yeah, I watched it last night. With your permission, I'd be happy to share it. I don't have it with me today, by the way. But
no, absolutely. The reason we just said do not distribute is because, as you saw in the video, it's not 100% finessed in terms of the video editing, so it is not the final product, but the content will not change.
Okay.
And this is through APSE?
APSE.
NAPSE, the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign.
Okay.
And it was produced by the Pesticide Task Force, which included beekeepers, crop advisors, farmers, pesticide companies, other nonprofits, a very large group of 20 or so individuals that created the content for this piece. So we consider it quite balanced.
I wanted to just add also that Pollinator Partnership, which is NAPSE's other entity, because NAPSE has EPA government people in it, and so there's certain things that can't be done in the conference, but could be done by the parent organization. But they were involved with the corn dust issue. And we're instrumental in looking for resolutions to that. And that, for those of you, did you mention that in your talk at all?
No, the corn.
Okay, so corn is planted, and soybeans as well, in large instances with pneumatic planters that actually shoot the seed into the ground. It's not tilled soil. It's been, this weeds and grasses have been killed. And then they just go in. It's a no-till, in some cases a never-till situation. And they come over and they just shoot the seed in these huge planters that might plant 40 or more rows at a time. And in order to get the seed out to the drill, they have to go through tubes. And it's all moved along, and they have little lubricants, which are graphite or something like that. And with corn especially, in particular, because it is so rough, as it's tumbling through the tube to get out there, it abrades the seed coating, which is a neonicotinoid and some other things that might be added to it, and that becomes mixed with the lubricant material. That is not shot into the ground. It just gets in the way when it gets to the end of the tube, and so it is actually exhausted out into the air, and under some circumstances, this has been causing huge bee kills downwind, because there's enough of the material in this dust to go out to coat plants into the next county at a toxic level. It doesn't happen every time, but it has happened in the Midwest, and everybody agrees it's a problem. It's not a matter of, you know, we're fighting about this. It's a problem that has to be resolved. NAPSE Pollinator Partnership was instrumental in getting all parties together to work on trying to resolve the problem with a better coating and a different lubricant material. So that's one thing I wanted to say. And I was going to go away from you guys, Vicki, if that's all right, unless there's something else you wanted to say.
Rich and I put together something, what EPA is doing regarding pollinators, but it wasn't part of our task, so we have another. But speaking to the corn dust, there's some links on our on that table that link you to EPA's information about the concerns of the dust, corn dust, and pollinators. So we can send that out so you can, but it's on EPA's website. It's definitely something I didn't see. Is anyone going to cover corn dust for outreach and education?
I do have.
For Oregon, we thought it was not a big topic, so that's how even.
Apparently, it's not as big an issue here. I don't think we use the same planting
mechanisms,
and I think we're doing cultivated soil rather than this no-till and all of that. But at any rate, it's it was an issue, and they had they were instrumental in looking for solutions using all stakeholders together rather than setting up an adversarial situation. Sure. So I have some other things. Well, go ahead.
I think the no-till, Katie could correct me if I'm wrong, but I went on a really wonderful ag tour 2 years ago, and one of the farms we went to, they were promoting the no-till, you know, injection process, and it looked really good. So it may be something that we're starting to, might start to see more in the future. I have no idea, but.
And there's also things that are being done, as George mentioned. I mean, they're starting to use new lubricants, new coatings, and I mean, this is something that the industry has been working really hard on to come out with, you know, new, better products to help avoid this, because, as you said, there was a recognition that this is a problem and something needed to be done about it, and I didn't realize that this organization was part of that, but.
You know, also I know DEQ through the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program is looking into going into wheat country, and there is a lot of treated seed in wheat, and they are included neonics in for their water quality testing. So that's another interesting piece to be looking at. It's not the pollinator as much, but we are seeing in the Midwest that these neonics are moving and running off of from treated seed, and we might that'll be something to look at into the future.
So other go ahead.
Real quick to what Amy was just saying, I did have some handouts on the federal and international one. I didn't get a chance to finish them and mail them to you. Maybe I can give them to you and pass them around, and I will email them out to you again later. That has the information she was talking about.
So when we're talking about nonprofits, I don't know exactly in this context what a nonprofit means. In that context, maybe I'm a nonprofit.
My family,
but,
we're
but at any rate, so there are, and I'm staying away from Beyond Pesticides and Center for Food Safety and those kinds of interests. I'm just talking about organizations that have significant other honeybee health issues. There's another one that is getting that is started and working. It's the Honeybee Health Coalition. It was initiated by Monsanto, but they have handed it off to a third-party facilitator, the Keystone Group, and it's a part of the Clinton Global Initiative for Conflict Resolution. It's a large group of stakeholders that involve everybody. You know, the government, as well as private beekeepers, as well as chemical companies, corn growers, you know, all these people come together and the object is to try and find solutions to problems with honeybee health. And in that, incident reporting and the barriers to incident reporting is one of the projects to try and, that they're working on. Another one is corn dust, and in particular, the next thing is that corn and soybeans are using a lot of cover crops because this no-till, never-till situation is ending up as a detriment to the soil. And so they have a stewardship portion of their, you know, they want their soil, their land to be fertile, and so they're actually going to some ideas with cover crops. And the this is a lot of interest around the board. They're doing it for their reasons, but the beekeepers are interested in it because a lot of these cover crops are in fact blooming plants like clovers and vetches, radishes, stuff like that, that bloom and take a Roundup ready field of corn that has almost no use for, it's a pollinator desert, and it's turning them into, at least for a portion of the year, into something that's valuable as pollinator habitat. So there's a big project on habitat and in all aspects, and there are some other things, a great deal of effort going into honeybee health management from the beekeeper's standpoint to try and establish some best management practices which are devoid of marketing. Right now, one of the problems is that, you know, there are advertisements for materials that would, you'd never know that they don't work or that they are, have harm to, you know, the drone semen or something like that, but they're for sale. And so to try and develop, I mean, who's going to do this? Because it has to be objective. But to try and solve that problem so that beekeepers aren't fooled by marketing into buying something that's ineffective or perhaps would have some problem downstream. So at any rate, so some of the things that the Honeybee Health Coalition is starting on, we're looking for some things to get done and move forward. It's no longer associated directly with Monsanto in any way, although they are collaborators. Along with Bayer and Syngenta and Pioneer Seeds and corn growers and soybean growers and Crop Life America and all the North American beekeeping associations and also, you know, EPA is represented and Department of Agriculture is represented, and I'm probably missing some huge group of people, but at any rate, the attempt is to try and get everybody that has a stake in this issue together. So there's another strong effort called Project Apis M, Apis mellifera, and that was started by the almond industry originally, but it now has funding that comes from a large area, not only from the chemical industry, and they do a lot of forage stuff, but they also do a lot of beekeeper training and other issues that are realizing that the almond industry needs bees in February, but those bees have to survive the whole year, and so their efforts are year-round across the whole country because the almond industry takes all of the bees from the United States in February, no matter what. So that's another one. The Bee Informed Partnership is actually a program. It's a large USDA grant being administered out of the University of Maryland, and it is the source of most of the data on bee losses, but also is the source for a training program called the Tech Transfer Program, where technicians go to participating beekeepers and do analysis of their outfit on several times during the year, as perhaps an extension agent might do if they existed in beekeeping for this purpose, and then give the beekeeper the results of their own, but also local and national results anonymously, so that they know epidemiologically what works and what doesn't, and what is successful in their area and nationally, and how they stack up. So those are some initiatives that are there. I did want to make mention of this. This is something that came out of Dr. Sicilli's Pacific Northwest Extension publication, PNW 591, and it is, you all have copies of it, it is a compendium of not only information about how to reduce pesticide kills for bees, not just honeybees, but also other managed bees and wild bees, and then it has the best information about products and their toxicity or lack of that's available all in one place, so that if you were looking at options, if you had three things that you might be able to do, you wouldn't have to search three different websites or, you know, anecdotal, but you could actually find out what your options are and what the impact is. The problem with this is twofold. It's available, but very few people have it. applicators do not have this book. And they can get it online, but again, it's a matter of it's available, but apparently that effort is not sufficient. So I'm not too sure if maybe we can make it more available or...
Yeah, we are actually looking into printing up about 7,000 of these.
Oh, okay.
But Louisa Hooven said that there might be some revisions of this.
Right.
The last revision was
five.
Yeah,
it took 5 years. So, and that's the other thing I wanted to mention is that it isn't revised often enough to be absolutely accurate. And that's something that perhaps we can figure out a way to do.
If we have to revise again, it has to go through the extension communications, and it takes a while to get the approval and all that. So there is a lot of bureaucracy involved. So I would say we will start with this. I mean, there are some minor additions. We can add them later, I guess. They're not critical at this time.
Yeah, we were wondering if it was going to be revised in the near future before we pay.
Probably, yeah. We published it last year, so I would say we may not do it until...
This was funded by passing the hat between ODA and California and Washington, and all the beekeeping organizations contributed to it, in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and California. And so right now, there's no way to revise it using those funds. They've been used up. So if we were going to revise it, you'd have to go out and pass the hat again.
But it took a while.
The revisions, this revision is just recent, but there are materials that have been registered in the interim and that are not in here. And so that's the other thing, is it needs to be more of a living document, I think.
I think some of the things you see, there are some stars in there. So we didn't want to even offend the chemical companies here, because there is not much information available. If you see a question mark on any of these chemicals here, like you see this green strip here, and then there's a question mark on this one. So that means that we have some literature someone has done at a university system, some research, but then EPA has some that information available. So wherever there was some questions, we had that information available. So that's what I would say. This is one of the most recent and updated information that anyone can
get. I just wanted to highlight the tool as something that I think could be used more. And maybe it's a part of our recommendation. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's going to happen anyway. There are a couple of other things. There are master beekeeping courses that are available. So there's some self-help. Mostly for smaller scale and beginning beekeepers. So there is training available and outreach, although you just simply can't control that. You can't require it in this day and age. People can buy a beehive. They don't have to register it, don't have to license it. It's not taxed. So, you know, nobody knows anything about it, and you can't make people do things that they don't want to do. So that's not a foolproof thing, but it is an effort from the industry in order to try and raise the quality of beekeeping activities. There are several, not only state, but also national beekeeping organizations, which are also nonprofits, and at least they're not for-profit. They have a lot of participation in many, many activities in all of these aspects, whether they are lobbying the government and the farm bill and so forth for specialty crops or for research monies or whatever, or participation in EPA's labeling committee. I did want to say one thing, just the last thing I'll say, is that it seems pretty clear that the label that's on a pesticide is not really meant to be an educational tool. There's too much information, and it's too much like reading a lawyer's contract with footnotes and stuff to be really meaning to be accessible for people. Even farmers will just, you know, cut to the chase. What do I do? You know, I mean, and homeowners aren't going to read a 24-page booklet. So the bee industry is really concerned about this, because our message, the one we want, is that if it's something that's going to kill bees, we don't want it on page 14 in little teeny letters. We want it right up front. And we would be in favor of something, even if it's only in the state of Oregon, in big red letters on the label that says it is unlawful to use this material applied to plants that are blooming visited by bees. Just, it's unlawful to do this. I mean, some clear statement in big letters that isn't lost in the label, because it's really clear that the label is not really intended to be an educational instrument. It's a legal document that describes all of the wheres and what fors, but it is not meant to be really an accessible instruction manual, and we'd like to have something much more clear up front that's just unambiguous that you can't avoid. That's
thanks, George. Anyone wants a break? If you want a break, we'll break for 5 minutes and come back again. Is that okay, or you guys want to go ahead? Okay.
20 minutes left. Or?
No, I think we have until 12:30, right? Yeah, we have 40 minutes, I guess. So, yeah, in 5 minutes, we'll be back here. Don't escape.
Yeah,
Jeff, are you still around?
I'm here for another few minutes.
Ah, so you didn't take a break. Okay.
All right, Jeff, if you got anything to share, why don't you go first, since you have to hop off?
Was the thing that I sent over to you from American Horse going out to the group?
Yeah, we've got the presentation online, and I think everybody's also got the paper copy.
Just thank you for your indulgence letting me go. My family's wanting to go out whitewater rafting, and so we're in between that and fun. So I'm gonna leave here. What the nursery industry is doing and what I wanted to provide to the group was the sense of what we're trying to do on a national level, as well what we're trying to do at the Oregon level. So there are a variety of large trade shows throughout the country that the nursery industry puts on. That include greenhouse growers, retailers, and also the growers community. So you have in your materials online a product produced by Dr. Joe Bischoff, who is one of our regulatory guys for our national association. So I commend you to kind of look at that. That's about as balanced, I think, that our national association is going to get. And I think it's not bad. It looks at a variety of different triggers for pollinator health issues. And so I just commend you to take a look at that. There were a lot of educational components during the trade show that I was recently at in Ohio just a few weeks ago. Our own large trade show, the Farmer Show in August, will have a couple different speakers with different perspectives talking to our community in late August. And we use all of our communication tools, all of our e-mail newsletters, and also our magazine to try to disseminate the need for pollinator health. So I just want to let you know that there is significant outreach being done by the nursery and greenhouse industry. I'm glad it's just not Oregon, but our national association has involved themselves in some of the groups that I think it was George mentioned right before the break. So I think that kind of accumulating information outreach tools is a possible outlet for this group to try to harness and try to get as much information out. So I don't know if there's any questions about that, but thank you for giving me a couple minutes to talk about the item I put in the hopper.
Thanks, Jeff. George, you have a question? Okay, then I think we'll go with Scott.
Can I ask a question?
Surprise,
Jeff, it's Christy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Sorry to ask you a question while you're trying to get out the door. There was just a slide that caught my attention that says, it's called Pressure Points in the Neonic Issue, and it says, legislation not so much, regulation not too bad, public perception huge challenge. And I'm just sort of curious, is that like the position of the national folks? Like, we don't like legislation, maybe we could stand some regulation, and then there's a huge public perception challenge. Am I interpreting that right?
Well, I really appreciate you raising that question. On the regulatory side, it's easier. What EPA is trying to do, and the science that they see EPA using, as well as some of these other big groups, there may be some regulatory action that is taken, And, you know, when we're looking at overall pollinator health and the health of the nursery industry in general, that doesn't alarm our folks as much as the fear factor in the public and our ability to explain the pros and cons of using pesticides in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that challenge is.
Got it. Okay. I was just curious.
It's not on the neonicotinoid issue, which there's also a thing, and there's like eight different things that they see as impactors to the pollinator community. But the whole issue of how that binary question of pesticides, yes or no, is a harder one for us as an industry to explain about the pro side of the chemistry rather than people just say you shouldn't use it. So that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. Thank you. I just was curious what that meant.
Jeff, I think George has a question, and after that we'll leave you alone, I guess.
Okay, just so that you get it clear, in there you had a slide on honeybee health, and you named tracheal mites and viruses. I think you need to change that to varroa mites. Tracheal mites are not a serious issue, and it would probably compromise your credibility if you left that in there in that way. And the other thing is, I was just going to ask you from your perception. So the media reports have been about linden trees and really not much of anything else. And I'm wondering if there are a lot of other blooming trees that I'm assuming ornamentally and so forth and so on. What from your perception, is this just linden trees, or why is it just linden trees that we're hearing about, and what you think is going on? Are there other areas where you think there's a potential for a problem, or is it just these ones for some particular reason? What's your take on that?
My point
was that your slide says tracheal mites, and tracheal mites are not the issue. I think that it's a mistake. You should change that to say varroa mites and viruses.
Yeah, the varroa is the slide right before it. Yeah, varroa mites and viruses is the slide before it. Then you see tracheal mites.
Can you go back a little bit?
Yeah.
But okay, I mean, I'm happy to give that feedback to our folks. But from my perspective, there are other flowering plants that you have to be careful about, especially when you apply it. For some folks, it's when you apply it, and we can talk about the various science about the residual side of that equation. But we're trying to get all the science, just not all. We've been trying to be careful, as Oregon's been trying to be careful, just not to look at the science I happen to agree with, but to look at the science that in total where we can try to find a common path. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I can't read your body language to see if you can come full of crack or not.
Okay, thanks, Jeff, and I think we'll start with Scott now.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Enjoy your rafting.
I'd rather be rafting. Sorry, guys. So you've got several different pieces within your packet here that I sent over to Beth earlier this week, and I just wanted to highlight a few of the things that are being done within the industry right now as far as outreach and stewardship.
So we see which ones you
have. Specifically neonicotinoids. The first one are a couple from Bayer Crop Science, and I would say that far and away they've been the industry leader on this issue. They've established an entire bee care program. They just recently opened a multi-million dollar bee care center in North Carolina in the Research Triangle Park area to do research on bee health, including interactions with pesticides, but even wider beyond that, really looking at bee health with a recognition of how important it is to their users that we have healthy bee populations as well. And so they've got the Bee Care Center. They've also, over the last couple of years, have done a bee care tour. They stopped here, I want to say, it was during last legislative session, January, down at Oregon State University, and they put on kind of their traveling roadshow, if you will, and they had some bees there, and they talked about pollinators, pollinator health, all the different things. Had a panel that I served on along with a couple of others that just kind of talked about all of these different issues. And so they're trying to get out there, be in front of it, try to communicate with users on a variety of levels, but also just with farmers and beekeepers in general, to try to make sure that we're having a good stewardship of the products and making sure that we have pollinators into the future. So this is just kind of a quick snapshot of what they have. I would highly recommend checking out their Bee Care website. There's a lot of great information on there. There's another thing from them in there that is something that they share, their Bee Care program. It kind of talks about what it is overall, but of course you can always dig down into the specifics, and I didn't know how much information you guys wanted. I didn't want to overload you, so I'm pointing you in the direction of some things that are good to check out. Some of the other companies are also doing some work. Monsanto is in here. It talks about their bee health and outreach, and all of these companies have also been very involved in some of these bigger NGOs at the national level, like George mentioned. I thought it was great that he followed up on the pollinator partnership, because that's where I got pointed to from a lot of people within the industry as doing good work and outreach and different things. And so that's really good. So there's their website. Then RISE, which is Responsible Industry for a Sound Environment, which is a national organization that works with different pesticide issues. They have a campaign called the Be Responsible campaign. You've got that in there as well. And they have created materials. The focus at this point has really been on users, best management practices, that type of stuff. But they are hoping to expand this program to a wider range of users. They deal with a lot of the urban applicators and that type of issue. So RISE is on the non-ag side. Heard of Crop Life America, they kind of do the ag side of things. RISE does all the non-ag side stuff, and so they're trying to broaden their outreach with some of this information on BMPs and stuff.
Is that this?
Yes.
Okay. Who's behind this
one? Who is this? So the name of the organization is Responsible Industry for a Sound Environment. It's RISE.
Got it.
And they're a national industry group. And again, this is just one of their sheets. There's a ton more information if you go to their website.
I have a question that
yep.
The words might sound harsher than I mean them to be, so just go with it. So I just noticed on here, in looking at the first paragraph, that it doesn't include pesticides as even like part of the problem, and I just wanted to know if that's generally sort of, is it considered by the industry to be all those things but not pesticides, or are pesticides included?
No, if you go down, it says speaking of pesticides
right at the bottom
of the page, and then talks about reading the label. And like I said, this is just their one pager.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on there, they've got a lot more information about BMPs and that type of stuff.
I was just curious, because it was like the multiple factors thing seems like not like a non-argument. Like it seems like something we all agree on, that there's this list and it would include all these things. But I just wanted to make sure that I didn't miss completely that is not something there's consensus about. But I think there is.
Yes.
But it's a suite of factors. And okay, just making sure. Thank you. See, pleasant, right? Not unpleasant.
That wasn't bad.
A little like.
You know. Wait till you have a kid, too, and then you can talk kids as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all good.
And then everything's joyful. Because kids are just do that.
Right. Thank you.
And then the last one I have is just the Syngenta website. They also have a bee site where they talk about some of the different issues. They've got videos that talk about the issue and they're all outreaching in different ways and in collaboration. There's a ton of information out there. I would say that the focus right now is really on the users of their products and how to outreach to them, but they're all looking for ways to outreach on bigger pollinator health issues as well. So there are a lot of great materials out there. It's all in, you know, how we communicate that information, which I think is a challenge in absolutely everything that we do. It's not that there's a lack of information of what to do, it's how we get that out to people.
So do you have these linked on your website?
We do not right now. I was actually thinking about that today, actually when I was looking at this, how I want to try to take some of the OSU stuff and get that on our website, frankly for a lack of me taking the time to put it on the website. Or having the time, I guess, would be more appropriate.
It's probably the only non-Xerces material that Xerces has on our website, so we could have something in common.
There we go.
Yeah, it's a great publication.
So have you given these to Beth? Will these be on our...
They are.
They're on our site.
Okay. Yeah. They're all up there, and then on the some of them are also linked on, like, the RISE one. They've got some live links in there, so when you look at them on the actual PDF, it will have links that you can click on as well and take you directly to the sites.
So I feel like this is probably would have been Betsy, and she's not able to be here today. There's all the retailers who are taking action, and I don't know if that's part of what you, I could also send links to some of their actions. I was just pulling them up.
Yeah, I just don't know enough about what retailers are doing, unfortunately. I don't have those connections, and I just found out today Betsy wasn't going to be here. So
Scott, this is one example that I found. Whole Foods has these things on their tables in their restaurant and their stores, and then they have these flyers where they have recipes on one side and information about bees on the other side. So just one example.
So in general, you think after all these incidents that we have been seeing about bee kill and all the media news and all, so is there a big effort in terms of industry? Are you guys trying to have more outreach events for your stakeholders, like maybe some monthly meetings or something to educate them more about use of pesticides?
Yeah, so I mean, of course, us as an organization representing users, we try to get information out as much as possible within our newsletters and try to get stuff to them. We've also tried to start to be in partnership more with beekeepers and kind of pulling our industries together a little bit. A few months ago, we had a beekeeper come to our board meeting and just kind of share his perspective. Harry, I'm sure you know Harry Vanderpool well. To come and just kind of share from a beekeeper's perspective, hey, when I'm doing my business, this is what I'm facing, this is what I'm thinking, this is what's happening. And we've got a pretty big board, and so it was a big group in there. And just starting that relationship and starting to have that interaction and try to improve some of that communication, I think, is really big. And then, of course, when ODA puts out information or anything like that, we're always shipping that out to our members to try to do that communication. So we're really trying to strengthen those relationships and work on that, because we think that so much of this can really be solved if we just get that communication together and an understanding of what each of us needs and to avoid those problems.
In terms of retail, you know, somebody was saying Wilco has a training program and so forth. I was just thinking, you know, last time I had a prescription I had to fill, you know, I paid for it, and it was sitting right on the counter, and they said, you can't have this until you talk to a pharmacist. So then a pharmacist, after a while, came over and explained to me all of the, you know, if don't do this and don't do that and, you know, and don't do whatever, you know. You know, when I go to Wilco or when I go to Home Depot or Costco or whatever, I mean, it's like those cashiers just, they change all the time. And maybe the store manager's been trained or whatever, but... You know, the purchaser doesn't really have any contact with the person who's been received the training or whatever. I'm just wondering, as you know, how, in, from your standpoint, how do you think we could actually have an impact on at the retail level on the purchaser? What kind of training, what kind of protocol would work in your mind?
it's hard for me to say because I don't understand the retail environment as well, exactly what that means. I mean, I know that there's always pushback on retail space and shelf space and what goes on, those types of things. I do know that people like Wilco, they're actually on our board, and they are always open to putting more information out there, having stuff next to products to do that. I don't know about the logistics of actually having, you know, a trained person to interact. I know that when you're talking about the larger ag customers and stuff, you know, they're using crop advisors. They've got people that are giving that kind of information. And so I think that really helps on that side. But apart from just having more information in front of them when they're getting the product, I don't know the logistics of doing more than that.
I'm hoping that Betsy or somebody will be able to provide that before we get done with this, because I think any kind of an outreach program, we have to know how this product is distributed and who, you know, who's using it. And I'd like to know more about what volumes. So if homeowners are using 90% of it, of the pesticides, then I'd like to know that, or if they're using 5%. But so I think that's on our work list at some point. If it's not,
maybe next meeting, I think.
I'll ask again if we get it added. But I think Betsy might be the one to answer that, or maybe you have more information that could be pulled out.
Well, as far as use patterns, I mean, that's
that whole retail.
It's going to be pretty tough getting numbers on that. But I mean, she'll be able to help with, you know, more of the retail side. It's a foreign world to me.
It just seems like this big black hole of knowledge. Do you know everybody that's, I'm not asking this right, erase that. People that are going in for food and shelter, that's your club. Are there other users, other commercial users, other ag users of these products that are not in your organization? Because you've talked about sending information out.
I mean, not as an industry. Obviously, we don't have every member in the state, every user in the state is a member. I'd love to find out a way to do that and work with you on getting there. But as far as an industry segment, no. I mean, we really cover all segments of users, even users you probably wouldn't think about as much, golf courses, utilities that spray right-of-ways, other users of these products who we don't think about as often, urban applicators, they're all members of us. So we've got a pretty wide swath.
So is Betsy the best one, do you think, to answer that?
But you don't have retail.
We don't have the only retail we have are the distributors who sell more to like the ag groups, more on a commercial type
Wilco
level.
Maybe.
Yeah, and Wilco does have, they've got a retail side, but as far as like a Home Depot or a Fred Meyer's even or something like that, we don't.
Actually, I don't know if this is pertinent, but I got into a discussion with somebody, I don't think in your office, at any rate, about how many tons of this stuff or that stuff or whatever is actually used. And the data, USDA is years behind, and I don't know how a retailer, you must contribute to that data. You don't.
No.
So you have no clue how many tons of this or that material are used in our state?
That is correct.
We had the pesticide use reporting system, but it was, as was mentioned earlier, defunded.
When I worked for the State Department of Food and Agriculture in California and later as a deputy commissioner, one of the quickest ways to get anybody from the Department of Agriculture to follow over with a cardiac arrest is start talking about regulation of homeowners' use of pesticide. It is the invisible 800-pound gorilla sitting in the corner. It's an issue that I don't think any Department of Agriculture in this country wants to deal with, because the regulations, the training and all that would make commercial ag look like a little thing in the background. But it is an issue we're going to have to deal with, because there's a lot more pesticides are being used by backyard homeowners with no training, no knowledge, have nothing about protective equipment, one cat feels good, I bet two's better mentality. You know, we have to eventually deal with it. And all these issues I've looked at with all these other states, nobody is dealing with it. And if this state wants to be the lead, that's one area. Now, I don't have the answer. I mean, I don't want to make these people or an ODA die. But it is an issue we really somehow need to try to get a grip on.
I think the national estimates are that households use about 18% of pesticides. Is that, you know, 60% is ag and the rest is commercial use? That's, I think I saw that from NAS data, or maybe it was sales and usage. Does that sound about right?
I bet.
It's concentrated areas. It's very different than ag.
Yeah.
But,
well, California has a mill tax on their pesticides. So
right, yeah. But we do not have a handle on homeowners. The closest we'll come would be maintenance gardeners, things like that. There is no regulatory requirement regarding the homeowner. The regulatory requirements we basically impose is at the point of sale. We restrict. You can't have this. But, you know, to say, oh, somebody wants to use Bayer 12 months, we have no knowledge how it's being used.
But you have, but California has sales information, though, right?
We can tell you how much, but that doesn't really answer the big question in regard to application. I mean, my neighbor could be using 3 gallons of it on an annual basis. I won't use any. The neighbor across the street, you know, there's no tracking beyond we've sold 5,000 gallons.
And we talked about rehashing pesticide use reporting, the conversations on how to track pesticide use. Really, it was, do we just do point of sale? How do we do it? And, you know, the questions and answers. But the one of the, it was actually going to be a survey was how it landed. Was that, and they had a pretty complex survey mechanism in place to learn a little bit more about use.
There were some proposals, several points, about tacking on a fee to the sale of homeowners pesticide with the intent of using that money to fund the Department of Agriculture's oversight. Politically, it never went anywhere.
Right.
Okay, I think we don't have much time, so I think it's my turn to go ahead with the OSU extension. Probably this needs more time, but if you guys can pull this page that I have, which says Oregon State University Outreach and Education Programs on Pollinator Health. Pretty much self-explanatory, but I'll just go over each of those things. Does everyone have this, or I can?
There's just so many important papers here.
Right,
we got a lot.
Is anyone missing this thing? I can.
I saw it.
You have for free.
You have an extra one.
There we go.
Probably. Yeah.
And here, you while you're talking. Waiting, everyone in their email has a list of some of the retailer actions. Yeah. So I just sent a link to that.
So, yeah, I have listed several entities that are involved with extension and outreach and education, actually, at OSU, but I'll just focus on the main ones here. So, just to be selfish, I have started with my lab, OSU Honeybee Lab here. So, I'm not going to talk about the diagnostic stuff, what George was mentioning. I do a lot of diagnostics when beekeepers, like, if there is a beekeeper in Portland, they lose a hive, and so ODA does send samples to me because they don't have that expertise there to look for pests and diseases. They do pesticides, but then I get samples for those. So that's just a small part. But I guess a lot of samples, we have some voluntary thing as well, where we had encouraged in the past the beekeepers to can send their samples if they have problems. So I still get some random samples, which I have to see where to squeeze that money for my students or whoever doing that kind of study. So funding is always an issue. So that's the reason we have not been doing like thousands of samples, but again, that's, I think, one important need. But again, this is an outreach thing, so I'm not going to talk much about the needs for money and other things at this time. But we do have a diagnostic lab where we look at pests and disease incidents for colonies in Oregon. So the first thing I would talk about outreach and extension is I do a lot of seminars, workshops, and bee schools every year. I just said 25 events per year, but some years I might do 30 or even 50 as well. I have only a 35% extension. That's too much for my department chair tells me that you're doing too many extension events where your job doesn't require. Then I say there is a demand. So So I'm on a tricky appointment. Mine is a 50 research, 35 extension, 10 teaching. So when you have a three-way split, it's a killer. And you don't know, your 35 extension becomes 135 as well. With all this B news now, I think there is a lot. I mean, I'm today here. By the time I go back, and my phone would have at least 20 calls, something about bees for sure, and about 100 emails. So just, I'm not complaining here. I really enjoy the stuff I do. But then it's demanding. I mean, there is more need for outreach and education than one person can do at OSU at this time. That's the whole point I'm trying to make here. So I do a lot of these bee schools, workshops, seminars, and we do these extension publications, which George was mentioning. I don't want to boast about this, but this is one of the most important ones that has come out recently. And this is, even I get calls from California beekeepers and producers as well. They ask me, can we get some 5,000 copies? I said, no, I'm not printing. I don't have money to print these things. But it's available online. They can go and, but somehow some people really like hard copies like these. So each one costs you at least $10. That's why I just brought only 10 pieces here for the committee, but they're expensive to have color copies like these. So Rose said you guys are planning to maybe print like 7,000 copies,
yeah,
so that's great.
Right.
I have one at home.
Oh, is it? Okay. Oh, no, no. You guys should have it because I don't know, maybe in future someone wants or discusses this.
Yeah,
you can give it to a beekeeper or a producer if they want. It's a useful document. I thought it's pretty useful. And so I listed that there as well. Then again, I think I bought... So we do other extension publications, which I listed here as PNW 623, which is evaluating honeybee colonies for pollination. I didn't bring copies for that, but that's another useful one that beekeepers really use it. And then we have a Bee Lab website where we try to provide most of the information that might be useful for beekeepers. Again, it's not an extensive one. I started at OSU 4.5 years ago, I would say, or 5 years now. So yeah, we are still trying to develop a good website where there is more information for outreach and education and all these things, for especially for beekeepers. And then we have this Oregon Master Beekeeper Program, which George tentatively mentioned about this. So I started this in 2011. So there are about 10 or 12 different programs in the nation, but Oregon didn't have one. So when I came to Oregon, we started this in 2011. We have some funding from ODA. It's a specialty block grant. I mentioned that as well in there. So we got about 130,000 from ODA, and then we have established this program, and it's pretty... We have a big wait list, so we are not even taking many participants because we wanted it to be a more hands-on experience rather than just asking them to read some material from our website or providing them something, because beekeeping is a skill. You can't just read books and learn it. So you need someone, a mentor for you to teach beekeeping. So this is a very unique program, the Oregon Master Beekeeper Program, and it's not just for beekeepers. That we have some even extension agents enrolled because they want to learn, because honeybee research it's a honeybee program is a very narrow area where beekeeping itself is a pretty area where you need a lot of skills to be learned, and there's not much avenues around to learn all those things. So I think this is a nice program which we are running, but again, resources are the main thing. So we don't have enough resources to expand this to a big scale. Again, it will again squeeze something from my other grants and other funding that I have. But again, it's going on, so I just wanted to mention that as well. And then we also deal with, I don't know how many of you know about OSU Extension Ask an Expert question. There's an online thing where anyone can, public can go and then ask a question, and we have to respond within like 48 hours or so. So I do get a lot of questions. I try my best to see how many we can answer, but again, this is just one avenue, how we are addressing some of the questions that the public or in general beekeepers have. So for each of those, I said further scope. As I said, we can do more seminars, workshops. They can be organized if there are more resources for this. When I say resources, it's manpower, funding, so there are several issues. But again, as I think I talked to Marla, and she's in Minnesota, but then Eric Musson, who just retired in California. It's a huge state, but I was surprised they don't have a master beekeeper program or most of the things that we are doing. I know they have their own things, and Eric Musson is pretty busy, very well-known person there. He just retired a couple of months ago. So not many states have this. I mean, we have been pretty ambitious, but again, it's just one lab, so we can do only certain things which are within our limits. I wanted to talk a little bit about this Integrated Plant Protection Center, IPPC. It's at OSU, and they do a lot of outreach and education as well. But it's mostly geared towards pesticide applicators, chemical applicators, and farmers. And some of you might know the director, Paul Jepson. So he directs that. And so when I was talking to him for this information, he said there are about 6 to 7 events they do every year, which are more focused on pollinator health. So again, there is a scope. They can do more of those. But again, they have to see how their resources are and how they can gear towards more of pollinator health. The next one I have here is Master Gardener Program, very important. Gail Langelato, she's the program coordinator, and I wasn't able to get more information from her. She was out on vacation, but I still know her well, so I can speak a little bit about here. And as Representative Reardon was asking more about how we can reach more urban audience, this is the main tool, our main audience. I know Xerces does a lot of things in Portland, but again, Master Gardener Program is the one that probably even I have to associate more with them so that we can pass on all these important things related to pollinator health. I think they already are doing some events, which again, I don't have very specifics here, but Master Gardener Program is doing a lot of things about pollinator health, educating public. And
Rich
is, again, yeah, so I totally forgot here, Rich is a Master Gardener, so he can go over that as well. It's not my area, but maybe we'll see. If I have 2 more minutes at the end, I will allow you to talk about Master Gardener Program because I have 2 more things to cover here. Then there is National Pesticide Information Center called NPIC at OSU as well, and David Stone, he's the director for that, and there is a goal and all those. You can read that, but it's basically, he told me that the audience he has is 90% is general public. They don't deal with commercial agriculture and others. And George, to answer your question about incident reporting, I have something there. It says ecological pesticide incident reporting. So I think this NPIC Center does that, and they have a portal where you can go and fill out those questions that you have about a bee kill or a human health problem, like Rose said. And he said there were 95% reports, what they get are all bee kills these days for the last 1 year. And I'm assuming because there is this heightened interest in bees and all this, Oregon has become a hot point for that as well. So this is all I'm talking about, the entire nation. They get reports from everywhere, not just from Oregon.
Right. It's housed at Oregon State.
Yeah, it's housed at Oregon State University, but yeah, the reporting
anyone
can do. And
it's also anonymous.
Yeah, it's anonymous. Yeah, you can.
So you don't identify the landowner, and you don't, mm-hmm. I don't think you identify yourself either.
Yeah.
You just report the incident, and so it gives gross data, but it doesn't initiate an investigation.
And all this goes to EPA, actually. EPA has the,
yes.
Yeah, EPA has the ability to extract everything that is reported here. So hopefully, as you asked Rose the question, does it help? I don't know how EPA is going to use that kind of information in the future, but I think it's useful. Someone has to report, even though...
We're almost out of time, but
yeah.
I don't understand how you would use that information.
Yeah, it's hard, I know. So David Stone, he told me that they still have a lot of opportunities here to expand on what they can do. So he suggested some of these, like developing some online material with us, with OSU, Honeybee Lab, and other entities that are there, using some social media outreach like Facebook. I think they have a big Facebook following as well. So he says there are other avenues that can be tapped into there. These are some specific organizations at OSU, but then we have a lot of extension faculty and extension agents. I mentioned some names here. Jeff Jenkins, some of you might know, he works with pesticides as well. Sujaya Rao, she works with the native bees, mostly bumblebees. Jody Francisco, Robin Rosetta is at the nursery. She works with the nursery industry at the North Willamette Station. So all these are involved in some way, maybe giving seminars and to their stakeholders. So I think, again, there is an opportunity where these people can do more if there is resources available for them. And then, again, at the end, I just mentioned some outreach education programs at other systems, which, there is only 1 or 2 people that are doing it. Again, I don't see that there is much going on in big states like California, especially with the public. There might be some going on with beekeepers and the stakeholders, the producers, but not with the general public, I would say. I'll stop there, and if you have any questions on those lines. No? That was pretty fast. Huh? if we don't have, then we may have to just plan on how we are going to use this information that we got from 4 different groups here. And Beth, you think we can just, we have notes somewhere where we can tally these things and come up with a summary, or you want each group to send their own summary as well, where they think there is a need, and on maybe next meeting we can spend 10 minutes to again go over those and then start our...
I think maybe both, a little bit of both. I mean, I can definitely summarize what's been presented here and kind of get it all together into one place, and then if you would all bring sort of the pieces that stick out the most as places to follow up, that would be helpful too.
Sounds good, or you guys are still confused on some things?
No? So we'll review your notes and then add, is that what you're saying, or should we bring something else to provide to you?
I guess I was thinking something else. So obviously review the notes, and if there is something that I've missed or that, you know, the emphasis should be different, let me know. But if there are particular pieces of what you've brought to the group today that you see as places to follow up in terms of the recommendations of the task force, something like that, that you want to highlight, bring that to the next meeting. That would be good.
But would you like a summary from each group, like at least?
No, that's okay.
You have the notes, okay. Good. Okay. Representative, do you have something to say?
Did you need help getting the work plan filled in? Do we have victims identified for the next?
We don't have victims, no, for the next. And I was just looking at the next meeting. So there are two tasks laid out there. One is deals specifically with applicator training, certification, and licensing. So I was kind of planning that Rose would fill us in on the current system in Oregon, and we can go from there in terms of recommendations for changes, additions, whatever. The other task has to do with other states and countries' pesticide regulations, and I think Rich and I may have made a huge step forward already in pulling that information together. I think Rich said that he was still working on some of the international pieces.
I can do some of the other states.
And some of the other states. The other piece I put on here was the presidential memorandum, and Rose had talked a little bit about that. Maybe you could expand a little bit on that at the next meeting as well, in terms of what your expectations are for what's going to come out of that.
Yeah, that would actually be really appropriate. And I also might have some laboratory data that people would be interested in from some recent bee kill incidents.
Oh, okay. All right.
Beth, can I bring a speaker from OSU? I mean, just like 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I think Jeff Jenkins, he wants to come in.
Yeah.
Because he has been involved with the topic that we discussed, what Rich was saying about use information of pesticides. I think I talked to him like a week ago, and he said when that happened in 1998 or sometime, he was a part of the discussion.
Oh, okay.
So that would be helpful, how feasible that is for ODA to do, and so he has a lot of insights on those. So I thought maybe he can give a 15-minute talk or something.
We're squeezing so much in, and
yeah.
You know, I'm not really sure, are we going to be able to get to all of these? And honestly, the stuff I put in on states wasn't regulation. I was trying to stay on outreach and education. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how. It seems like a lot to try to cover, and
yes.
I don't want us to not have enough time for any of them. But they all sound valuable, so I'm not sure what.
So I'm really open to feedback on this, but when I put together the work plan, my concern was just that the legislation is very sweeping in terms of what the task force is supposed to look at, and the amount of time that the task force has is not large. So, you know, to the extent, for example, with other states' regulations, if in your work as you review that, you identify things that kind of rise to the top, I would stick to that. At this point, I mean, whatever summary information you can give me that I can include in the final report, so it's kind of a compilation of the information that the task force has either looked at directly or collected, I think that's great. But it's sort of filtering that to the place where it can turn into a task force recommendation that I think is a little tricky, and I'm not quite sure how.
And I was trying to be unbiased, whether I liked it or not, I was going to present it. But I'll try. I'll bias.
Well, I think, you know, to the extent there's something different in one of the states that really stands out, you know, I think your bias in terms of your bringing to the task force your perspective that's important for the group to know about, that's fine. We are definitely working our way through this, so, you know, I don't have, like, this grand plan that I'm sure is going to work
we'll see how it goes.
At some point, I'd really like to hear you tell us what the legislature is likely to accept in terms of a recommendation. Now, that shouldn't harness us in any way whatsoever, but it would be interesting to me to know what you think is likely to be, you know, realistically approved, and what is unlikely. Maybe nothing, but.
And I don't want to just respond off the cuff today that, but
at some point,
absolutely, we'll do that. So, this is right now. I'm still pulling in information.
But my feeling is that this, like so many things, we have to approach it in baby steps. We're not going to hit a home run right away. We're not going to solve the problems of the world one step. But I do. It seems like I'd just like to know how big a step we can take.
And you know, the legislature doesn't move quickly, so sometimes it may be, maybe we map out a series of things that happen over a couple of sessions. I just feel so encouraged by the exchange that I'm hearing today and what I'm learning, and this is pretty exciting. So.
Thank you very much. Then we will adjourn the meeting for today and see you guys again on 6th.